So again, in this session, we're going to continue our Vipassana practice. So again, today, we're going to be working at the foundation level of coming to realize impermanence. And the way we're going to do that again is through scanning the body. It's very much recommended we first start focusing on the body. So that's what we're doing. So in this session, then we're going to do the similar to the last session, scanning from the tip of our head, top of our head to the bottom soles of our feet. But in this session, I'm not going to be guiding it, so you know how to go through the stages. So at the beginning stage, I very much recommend to go through in stages as we did. You can use a different order if you prefer to go down the right side and then the left, that's okay. If you prefer to use the front of the body and then the back, that's okay. So the order is not that important, as long as you cover every part of the body. And again, go at a speed that's suitable to you. So if you are not finding any sensations in a particular part of the body, just stay there a little bit longer until you start to pick up some sensations. When you do, then move on to the next part. If after a little bit of time, maybe a minute or so, you don't pick up any sensations, then move on to the next part. And if you get to a part where there is some fairly sort of gross, heavy sensation, then just stay there a little bit longer and observe it objectively and then see if it changes or not. And then again, move on. And again, if you get through the whole scan and there's still time left, then just go back to the top and start again. And scan again. Okay, so let's do that practice, and then we'll go back into the text. So keeping the back nice and straight. And allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed. Releasing any tension using the out-breath. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly, not trying to manipulate the breath in any way. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Not dwelling in the past. Not anticipating the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to settle in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And having prepared the body and the mind, we can now begin the Vipassana practice. Again, focusing on the body. Simply scanning through the body from the crown of the head to the soles of the feet and observing the reality of the body, observing whatever sensations arise within the body. And again, go at your own speed and make sure that you cover every part of the body in the scan. Any questions about the practice? Yeah, you scan like a fMRI or something, you know, you just go straight like this through the body. You know, right. Like a cross section in, you know, at this point what's going on. Mm-hmm. That's how you start, but often then you can do it in chunks as well. It's the same idea, but of course you're looking inside the body except on the surface of the body, that's all. Yeah.
If you have already scanned a certain part, like for example, you scanned left hand and you are on the right hand and then you start feeling something in the left hand, you come back in the left
No. You ignore it. Yeah. Otherwise, of course, we're allowing the mind to dictate to us, so then we're just getting distracted again. So if you're scanning and you get to a certain point and then you notice in another part of the body some sensation, just ignore it. If you've gone through that, then ignore it. If you haven't got to it yet, wait till you get to that point. Otherwise, you're jumping all over the place.
About the
essence of this meditation. Correct. Correct. Not only, because we're going to look at more than that tomorrow, but
But this practice, it will never say me anything about the ignorance of this world, something like that.
It will, indirectly, because but also when I mentioned before, we talked about the four applications of mindfulness. What do we investigate? So we start with the body because that's something very familiar and very easy for us to focus on. Then it suggested we look at feelings, you know. Then look at the mind and then phenomena. And phenomena can mean anything. So we can do it in this order. It's what, sorry?
Intellectual action. Like, I can feel my body.
Yeah.
It's physics. It's what I feel here is just nerves. But I can't feel like external objects.
No, but we can't.
I can say about external objects, it is intellectual knowledge.
I think we can observe with our eye that things are changing. So that's direct observation. That's not intellectual.
Why to meditate? Like if you can take a microscope or observe everything changing, clouds moving, and for solid objects you can take a microscope or use science.
Because, again, it's intellectual knowledge. So in meditation, we are... And that's why we focus on the body, because it's something that we can sense directly through the tactile sensations, is that intellectual knowledge is what we gain by looking at a microscope and so forth. That is good. It's a start. But intellectual knowledge is not driving our behaviour. We can be the smartest person in the world. We can have the best intellectual understanding of reality in the world and still be completely miserable, because our intellectual understanding is not driving our behaviour. So yes, intellectually we know things are impermanent because of microscopes and science has shown that. And we all accept that because it's been established. So intellectually we accept that. But is our intellectual understanding of that fact, is that somehow helping us in our life? Not really. I mean, if we were constantly reminding ourselves of that fact, then maybe a little bit in our behaviour it could help us. But our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behaviour is driven by our instinctive habit. And the way we relate to things instinctively is not that they're changing all the time. It's as if they're somehow stable. You know, experientially, this laptop's the same laptop that was here yesterday, it'll be the same laptop here tomorrow. And that's how we relate to it. Well, it does, because it's all material world, and from physics we know that the material world, whether it's atoms in a laptop or atoms in a body, are the same, isn't it? So by directly, and this comes in emptiness as well when we look at, by directly realizing the nature of change in the body, we can then realize the nature of the physical world, because it's the same basis.
You mean to just do a kind of induction, like?
No, it's not in.
I'm changing, so that both must be also changing.
Well, it's not really induction. It's because they have the same basis. They're based on atomic theory. It's atoms. It's the same basis.
But still it's intellectual.
No, it's not. It's not. In fact, this is what you're going to find, is that by focusing on the body and really coming to realize the change in the body, realize, not just understand intellectually, what you will find is, if, again, we have a good basis of shamatha practice, so that it really penetrates this realization, then that realization will stick with us. See, maybe I'll mention it now. I was going to mention it later, but it's a good time now. Is we go through three stages of practice. And I like the Tibetan words because they're very short. Go, nyam, tok. Go, Tibetan word go, means intellectual. And so we first gain an intellectual understanding, and in this case, that things are changing. I think we've all probably done that already at school and so forth. So for impermanence, we've already got that. But again, that is not really going to help us much in our life, because our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual understanding. It's driven by our instinctive habits. So we need to bring this into experience. So we meditate, like we did now, scanning the body, for example, noticing arising, passing, and then we come to experientially, not intellectually, experientially, we come to see change. This is nyam. Nyam means taste or experience. But if we're not very focused, if we really haven't done much shamatha practice, we do the scan the body, we notice, yes, change. And then we come out of meditation, nothing changed. Because this experience is very superficial. It didn't penetrate very much because our mind is not very focused. So if we do more shamatha practice, our mind is more calm, more clear, more focused, then we do the scan, then this experience will penetrate more. Meaning that when we get out of the meditation, this experience is still affecting our mind. And then when we're looking at the body and anything else, this experience of change is still affecting our mind. For example, one thing that often people notice is if they do this scanning the body and they have a more deeper experience, when they get out of meditation and start walking around in their daily life, they go, oh, that thing doesn't irritate me anymore. Those things used to irritate me all the time, but now they don't seem to irritate me. Why? And the reason is because this experience is still affecting the mind, so this stimulus, it could be a person, it could be an object or whatever, that irritates us a little bit suddenly doesn't irritate us anymore. And it's because experientially we're seeing these things as changing. That's why. It's what, sorry?
It's
very
strange.
Strange.
Yeah, it seems to me being strange because, like, yeah, there was that effect that things which were irritating me before somehow miraculously did not irritate me after that for maybe 4 months or something like that. But I didn't understand that, like, they're changing or something like that.
Because it's experiential. It's not intellectual. We're experientially seeing things in that way, directly. Even though intellectually we may not appreciate that that's what's going on, but that's what's actually happening. But of course, as you said, they stopped irritating you for about a month and then back to irritation, yeah? Because this has worn off. This may last a few minutes, a few days, a few weeks, maybe a month, then gone. So we need to go to this level. Realization, talk. For this, we need shamatha. We need a very stable, very clear, very focused mind. So when we come to see example impermanence within the body, it's not just a little taste that sort of wears off eventually, but it's a realization which stays with us. So this is why shamatha is important, because to get to here, we need shamatha. To get to here, from here to here, we need to meditate and have a little bit of focus, because if we meditate and we're completely distracted, we're probably not even going to get to this stage. Okay, let's go back now into the text. So we're now looking at, briefly, the Tantra Mahamudra level of the practice. So remember, Tantra Mahamudra, we're gaining access to this very subtle mind we have. Here it's called luminosity, sometimes called the mind of clear light. And we gain access to that, as we saw here, by doing this completion stage practice where we're focusing on a particular point in the central channel, and that's causing all the subtle energies to enter and dissolve at the heart chakra, causing the heart chakra to open, causing this very subtle mind to become active. And this is a very blissful mind, and we're using that to realize emptiness. So that is Tantra Mahamudra. And we saw that it says this is dependent upon having obtained the four pure empowerments, having properly guarded the commitments and vows, so this is the ethics within Tantra, and having familiarized yourself with generation stage. So these are the basis for doing this practice, this completion stage practice, this penetrating the subtle body. And of course, to even begin that, we need the basis of renunciation, bodhicitta, and have some wisdom of emptiness as a basis. Then we can take empowerment, have our tantric vows, and then do some generation stage practice, which involves a lot of visualization and often some mantra recitation and so forth. And then on that basis, we can enter into this practice when we're ready. The teacher will give us some instruction on how to do this. If we go to the next paragraph then, it says here, when such an exalted wisdom, so an exalted wisdom, whenever you see the word exalted wisdom, it means a wisdom realizing emptiness, realizes emptiness by way of a generic image, it is a similitude luminosity. And when it realizes emptiness directly, it is the actual luminosity. So that is a little bit talking at this level of realization of talk, is that When we first meditate, and we're going to look at this much more detail later in the retreat, and we're meditating on this idea of emptiness, when we first even get to the point of realizing emptiness, in that experience, there's still a sense of me, the meditator, experiencing emptiness. So there is still a sense of a subject-object duality. So that appearance of emptiness is conceptual. So that's what means here by generic image. So we're realizing emptiness conceptually in terms of a generic image of emptiness, sensing emptiness as an object, we are the subject. So at realization level of emptiness, we can have conceptual realization, which is this what's called here the generic image. And then if we keep practicing, we will break through that and have a direct realization of emptiness, a non-conceptual direct realization. And so that's what's mentioned here as the actual luminosity. So the actual luminosity is when we're in that very subtle clear light mind realizing emptiness directly. When we're approaching that, we have what's called a similitude, sort of an approximation, where there's still a little bit of a sense of duality. There's still a sense of me, the meditator, and emptiness, the thing I'm realizing. So that's what's mentioned here. And then it says, the mind that is in the nature of that luminosity, so when here we're talking about the very subtle mind, of course, is taught using such terms as. So here is some different terms that you may see in texts when it's talking about the very subtle mind. The definitive meaning short a, the indestructible drop. So the indestructible drop is, I said that the very subtle mind, the one we're talking about here, is associated with the very subtle wind energy that is the body. And so these are inseparable, and that together, collectively, they're often referred to as the indestructible drop. And then the uncontrived mind. So here the word uncontrived has the idea of not some sort of conceptual mind. But we're talking, because these minds here, both the coarse and subtle mind, are conceptual. This very subtle mind is completely non-conceptual. So uncontrived mind is referring to the fact this, as opposed to the more coarser conceptual minds. The ordinary mind. here the word ordinary, coming from the Sanskrit and Tibetan, more has the idea of essence, the essence of the mind. And then primordial mind. And primordial mind here is very commonly used in Kagyu and Nyingma school, referring to this very subtle mind. Because again, because it's completely non-conceptual, it's actually beyond time. So hence primordial. So primordial doesn't really mean here something that has no beginning, but it really means something that's even beyond time. So these are some terms that you sometimes see for describing this very subtle mind. Another word, of course, is the clear light mind. That's commonly a translation that has been translated here as luminosity, but often people translate it as clear light mind. But clear light mind can be a little bit misleading, because then people have the idea that it's some sort of light that they'll see that's very clear or something. But that's not really the idea here. And then in the last paragraph it says, it is the Mahamudra accepted by Saraha. So Saraha was a great practitioner of Mahamudra from the 8th century Indian master. And Saraha is very well known for writing these, what's called, dohas. A doha, as we're going to shortly see, is, so you can sort of translate the word doha as like a song of realization. And a doha is something that is it's very poetic that is written or actually sung to a disciple. So, and it's based on personal experience. So what we're going to see now, because I'm going to quote this book here, is that early in the Mahamudra tradition, a master who was accomplished Mahamudra practitioner would impart their experience to this disciple by singing these spiritual songs through their own experience. And if the student was sufficiently ripe at a sufficient level, that would trigger an experience of Mahamudra in the disciple immediately. So to actually talk a little bit about that, I'd like to read a little bit about, from this book here, Pointing Out the Great Way, from Daniel P. Brown. He's an American scholar and meditator. This is quite a good book on Mahamudra. There are two or three main Tibetan texts that are often referred to in the various Mahamudra traditions. And what he's done here is he's sort of synthesized those three main texts, distilled them into one sort of cohesive whole. And he also brings in a little bit the sort of Western psychology perspective. So it's quite academic, but it's very well written. So this can be quite a good reference book. Maybe not a light bedtime read, but quite a good reference book. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what's being said here, particularly relating to Saraha and these Dohas, what he says about the Mahamudra. So remember here, we're talking about two levels of Mahamudra, the Sutra and Tantra. But here, based on these ideas of Doha, sometimes we can talk about a third level of Mahamudra. So we can talk about Sutra, Tantra, and what's called Essence Mahamudra. And Essence Mahamudra is, for the very high-level practitioner who is very ripe, they don't need to go through all of these practices to realize Mahamudra. They can simply have the master sing one of these experiential songs to them, and then through that they have a realization of Mahamudra, of the nature of the mind. So to talk a little bit about that, I'll read from this book here. It's on page 8, and he says the following. In Buddhism, a popular distinction is made between sutra and tantra methods for spiritual development. The sutra methods generally are drawn from the practices of early Buddhism and are typically threefold: preliminary practices to make the body and mind fit for formal meditation, concentration training to stabilize the mind, so that's shamatha, and special insight practice, that's vipassana, to realize the mind's essential nature. So we've seen that already. The tantric practices are twofold, which we briefly looked at. Generation stage practice, which entails complex visualizations to stabilize the mind and manifest its essential nature. So that's what we saw. And then completion stage, which we just looked at now, practice which enhances realizations at the subtle and very subtle levels of mind. So the completion stage was to gain access to this very subtle level of the mind. Completion stage practices may involve manipulating the body's energy currents, so those subtle energies which we talked about, in order to make the very subtle mind more readily accessible. Some authors add a third category of Mahamudra: Sutra, Tantra, and Essence Mahamudra. Essence traditions are exemplified by the Mahamudra and the Dzogchen systems of meditation. So Dzogchen was the sort of equivalent system within the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. The essence viewpoint asserts three levels of mind: coarse, subtle, and very subtle, as we saw here. The coarse level pertains to mental content such as thoughts, sense perceptions, and emotions. That's what we It's the mind that we have now. The subtle level is the fleeting mental activity surrounding sensory experience before that activity becomes full-blown mental content. So the subtle level of mind is the subtle beginnings of conceptual activity that then manifest at the coarse level. That it says the essence perspective, the essence Mahamudra, cuts right to the heart of the mind's natural state and invites a practitioner to awaken to it in direct experience, the result of which is enlightenment. The early essence tradition did not include extensive descriptions of spiritual practice. The extraordinary view of the mind was directly transmitted from master to student. The skillful means in the essence tradition is this pointing out instruction. In this context, the master's job is 1, to assess accurately the state of the student's mind, 2, to directly influence the student's very subtle mind so as to remove hindrances that might otherwise obscure realization, 3, provide a precise description of the mind's real nature, and 4, awaken the student to direct realization of the mind's natural condition. The extraordinary practitioner gains this realization once the master directly points out the real nature of the mind, and it's usually through these dohas, these sort of poems of experience. Ordinary practitioners generally do not understand the pointing out instructions because their minds are too clouded by coarse-level thoughts, mistaken ideas, negative emotions, and dualistic perception of the external world. Therefore, ordinary practitioners must first refine their minds through standard practices before the essence view can be introduced. So, of course, these sort of poems and in forms of these pointing out instructions, very poetic, very nice. And so when us Westerners see that, we go, ooh, that's for me, I want that. But as he said, is that our minds are too coarse to really appreciate these instructions. They sound nice, but nothing happens. In the original Mahamudra tradition, the earliest masters literally sang the disciples into enlightenment with poems called dohas. The mind's natural condition was directly pointed out by the master, who then gave instructions to negate any artificial activity during meditation. Realization of the mind's awakened wisdom was a consequence of these pointing out and non-meditation instructions. This is essence Mahamudra. Later in the tradition, Mahamudra practitioners first learned to refine the ordinary mind through mastering traditional generation and completion stage tantric practices. And then they took up Mahamudra either concurrent or following completion stage practice. This is Tantra Mahamudra. So then they had to be able to take advantage of these pointing out instructions, these essence instructions. They needed to refine their mind through the tantra level of practice. Still later in the tradition, practitioners first refined the ordinary mind through mastering standard concentration and special insight meditation, so standard shamatha and vipassana meditation, as we're going to look at here. And after some degree of mastery had been achieved, Mahamudra was then introduced. This is Sutra Mahamudra. Thus, Mahamudra can be sutra, tantra, or essence practice, depending on which practices are used to refine the coarse and subtle levels of mind before essence instructions are given to address the very subtle mind. So, this is going to now come up in the over on the next page, on page 3. But before that, just to finish the last paragraph here, it said, this Tantra Mahamudra is accepted by Saraha, Nagarjuna, of course, great Indian master, Naropa and Maitripa, two great Indian masters who helped introduce Mahamudra into Tibet. It is the innermost essence of the Anuttara Yoga class of Tantra, and it is the principal subject matter taught in the seven accomplishment texts and in Saraha's three cycles of Dohas. So here we see Saraha, who has three songs called the three Dohas, and they are song to a king, song to the queen, and song to the people. So apparently he had a song to the king, and the king at the time was ripe for this, and then the queen, and then all the other people who are ready. And here it says it's the essence of the Anuttara Yoga class of Tantra. So maybe I'll briefly talk about that, and then it's going to be time for dinner, actually. And then we'll finish this session. So here then, when we talk about Tantra Mahamudra, then we can talk about four classes of Tantra. The first one is called Kriya Tantra in Sanskrit, or Action Tantra. And in each one of these classes of Tantra, they progressively get more subtle, more difficult to practice. Kriya Tantra, Action Tantra, emphasizes what's called external yoga. So at this level of Tantra, there's a lot of emphasis on external behavior. Cleanliness and so forth, in particular the type of food you eat and so forth. So here, sometimes when you go to a Buddhist center and they provide meals, often you'll find that they don't do it use any garlic, onions, radish and so forth. And that's based on this, is that here, because they're putting a lot of emphasis on external things like cleanliness and so forth, and food, then here we are to avoid any sort of food that may agitate the mind. And so it's said that those sorts of foods are very strong and can agitate the mind. Then the next class of Tantra is called Charya Tantra. Translated often as Performance Tantra. And here in Charya Tantra, now there's a little bit more shift to inner yoga, to inner meditation. So now there's a little bit of a balance between outer practice and inner practice. The third one is called Yoga Tantra. Now the shift is more towards inner yoga and less emphasis on outer yoga, outer activities. And then the last one here is what's called Anuttara Yoga. Often translated as Highest Yoga Tantra. And here there is a complete emphasis on inner practice, on inner yoga. So here, when we're talking about Tantra Mahamudra, and we talk about generation and completion stage, we're talking this level. But these can be a sort of a build-up to this level. In Tibetan Buddhism, when you're introduced into tantric practice, then initially, often, you'll be introduced at this level. And at this level, then you don't have tantric vows and all these commitments that you have at this level. And you get introduced in a very easy way, and you have maybe a little practice where you're visualizing Chen Rezig or Tara or something like this in front of you, chanting a little bit of mantra and so forth, to get yourself a little bit familiarized. In Tibetan Buddhism, you really don't see too much at these levels. It exists, but not very common. But then you get a lot of tantric practices here, and this is what we're talking about here in Tantra Mahamudra. We receive empowerment into this level of tantra. And empowerment, often you get what's called the four empowerments. And these empowerments empower us to practice this. And remember, at this level, we saw in the chart, there are two practices, generation stage, completion stage. The completion stage was this manipulating subtle energies. The generation stage involves often a lot of visualizations, doing a sadhana practice and so forth. To empower us to do the first one, the generation stage, the first empowerment. And then the other three empowerments that we receive empower us to do the completion stage practice. So that's what's mentioned here in terms of that the Tantra Mahamudra is the innermost essence of this class of tantra. Okay. Any questions about that? The four classes? Yeah.
Meditation practices we do here, Shavata and Vajra, is somehow corresponding to this, as it was said, this Mahamudra is Anuttara Tantra Mahamudra.
The Tantra one?
Yeah.
This one?
Yeah. And
correct.
This one, what we are reading here, is Sutra or Tantra one?
The which?
This
text.
This text, yeah.
Well, this text covers both, but as we saw earlier, in the middle of that page, when he says there are sutra and tantra, he says, here I will explain the first one rather extensively, sutra. And the latter one, and since the latter one will be presented only using only few words, I will explain that first. That's why we're looking at Tantra Mahamudra now. So he's basically just giving us a few words to give us some idea what's the next level of practice. And then, for the rest of the whole text, we're doing Shamatha Vipassana at sutra level. So all of our practices in this retreat are at the sutra level. Before that.
So
before that.
And these,
to enter into any of these practices, this is all tantra. And the basis for any level of tantra here is renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom of emptiness. Because we need to have the bodhicitta to have the right motivation for doing tantra. We're striving for enlightenment. And in tantric practice, we are, sometimes tantra here is called the resultant vehicle. Because in the sutra level, we have the perspective of, this is where we are, and we need to strive for enlightenment. So we're looking forward to enlightenment. What practices do we need, like the six perfections, what practices do we need to engage in to create the cause to achieve that result? So we're looking forward. So it's called the causal vehicle, from the perspective of the cause to achieve that result. Tantra is the resultant vehicle. And in Tantra, we have the complete opposite perspective. We're doing the practice, whichever level we're talking about, from the perspective of the result. Particularly when we do generation stage practice, or even we do some sort of sadhana practice here, we visualize ourselves in a fully enlightened form and do the practice from that perspective. But to be able to do that properly, you know, we need to have a realization of emptiness at some level. Because otherwise, what we do in this sadhana practice is we go, okay, now I'm pretending to be Tara. Now I'm pretending to be Chenrezig. And then we've completely missed the point. And if we have that approach, we're just increasing our delusion, our ego grasping. You know, oh, I'm Tara, I'm Chenrezig, I'm enlightened. with self-grasping. So actually it's counterproductive. And we can even become completely deluded thinking that we're enlightened. So if we're doing this sort of practice, this visualizing as a fully enlightened form, with the idea, I'm pretending to be fully enlightened, we've completely missed the point. Completely missed the point. Because there is no me here that's pretending to be enlightened. That's why we need a realization of emptiness. Because then, properly, we arise out of emptiness as in the fully enlightened form. We're not poor old me here is pretending to be enlightened. It's not like that. So if we have an understanding and realization of emptiness, then when we do any of these practices here from the perspective of the enlightened state, we're doing them correctly. And we are cultivating wisdom, not increasing our delusion by pretending to be enlightened. So that's why it's very important whether we're doing any some little Kriya Tantra or sadhana practice here to have that basis of emptiness. Otherwise it's just a game, a potential game that could make us more deluded, not overcome our delusions. Because the other thing here, and this is coming up actually the next paragraph, which I'm going to look at tomorrow morning, is that we have in Tantra, we have wisdom and compassion conjoined always. And so to have them conjoined means that in all of these practices, we need to be sustaining that with the wisdom of emptiness. Otherwise, it doesn't work. It'll in fact just create more delusion. So this is a very important point. Okay. Okay, we've run over time there a little bit. Sorry about that. Let's break here for dinner. This evening, again, remember, each evening I want to go into the compassion wing of the practice. So we're going to doing various compassion sort of type meditations this in the evening. And then I'll talk a little bit about some of the compassion practices, which also, of course, come within the preliminaries and foundation. And then we'll end the evening, as we did yesterday evening, with the Shavasana corpse posture meditation at the end of the session. So that's coming at 7:30, but let's take a break, have some dinner, and come back at 7:30.